This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. When matters of the heart intersect with the tangled web of our legal system, the ending is not always happy. Divorce is among the most treacherous of these crossroads. It's fairly common for couples to dissolve a marriage in modern American society, and that doesn't mean it's easy, nor does it have to be devastating. As Law and Order Week continues, we're going to take a look at one of the most common legal proceedings, divorce, and the many shapes it can take. Now, let's start with a Hollywood vision of modern divorce. Here's a clip from the opening of the 2005 blockbuster Wedding Crashers.
I told you this was a bad idea.
You know what, Ken? The bad idea would be to let your client walk out of here today and drag this thing out for another year, wasting more time and wasting more money. The only good idea is to let me and John do our job and mediate this thing right here.
You want to hear the crazy thing? I know it doesn't feel like it, but we're making progress.
Mm-hmm.
We settled the deal with the cars. Let's see, that takes us to frequent flyer miles. We're flying.
Those are mine.
I want them.
You know what we're going to do? We're going to split them right down the middle. How'd that be, Mr. Kroger?
It would be not good at all. I earned those miles.
Yeah, you earned them flying to Denver to meet your whore.
Oh, Lord.
Well, she's not afraid to express herself sexually, if that's what you mean.
She is a stripper, for God's sake.
She is not.
Her name is Chastity. She is white trash. Same as you. Hillbilly.
All right, well, that's not the route that everyone takes. With me in the studio are Jonathan Weiler and Ann Menkins. Jonathan and Ann's divorce involved little help from lawyers and a great deal of cooperation between the two of them. And they've written about their divorce for HuffingtonPost.com. They're with me in the studio now. Jonathan and Ann, welcome to the program. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Let's start by telling everybody, first of all, that we're going to take phone calls at 877-962-9862, emails at sot@wunc.org. And joining us now by phone is Alice Stubbs. She practices family law at Therrington Smith LLP in Raleigh. Alice, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Phone calls, 877-962, emails, sot@wunc.org. How would you describe your divorce? Do you know people who were divorced, your parents? Were you involved yourself? Did special legal hurdles make it tougher for you? Give us a call on today's program. Jonathan and Ann, let's start with your story. First of all, how long were you married before you decided to get divorced?
We were married for 6 years when in September of 2001 we decided to split up.
And what led to that decision, Ann?
Well, we had been in marital therapy for about 3 years at that time. Is that right? And we just came to the realization, I think our therapist asked us each why we would want to be someone somebody had settled for. And we realized that that was sort of the story.
Yeah, we did not have a good answer to that question.
So you realized there was something going on. You worked on it for a while to try to save the marriage, finally decided. Then did you become conscious, because you've written about this in the Huffington Post, and you certainly have worked at it. You've thought hard about it. So it wasn't easy by any means, but it didn't have and didn't involve a lot of the some of the struggles and some of the pain that you see associated with others. Did you go into this thinking, look, we're not going to have that kind of divorce?
I went into it fighting. I did not want to get a divorce for a long time. And I think part of my resistance was this feeling that it was going to ruin our lives, our daughter's lives. So actually there was a lot of pain before the divorce while thinking through how in the world we were going to do it. So, by the time we finally came to that decision, yes, we decided we were going to try to do it without the pain.
How old was your daughter, Anne, when you separated?
She was almost four.
And how big a part did that play, your daughter's role in all this, the fact that you had a daughter in how you were going to have this divorce?
Well, certainly, you know, I would say she was unquestionably the number one reason that we waited as long as we did to make the decision that we did. And we were certainly very concerned about how this would affect her life. But I think we each felt that our relationship, which was not a high conflict relationship, but that it was sort of unhappy enough that we did worry a lot about the consequences of her ongoing exposure to our unhappiness, how that would affect her. And so at a certain point, I think we felt that as difficult as the idea of divorcing, given that we had a child, was, we thought that there were at least as many drawbacks to staying together as there were to splitting up.
And you established some guidelines for yourselves. Tell us about them.
Well, I think the most important one was that our decisions would be based on what was best for her. Now, of course, we realize most people, most parents try to do that, and that's what we tried to do. One of the ways that was manifested was we decided that was best for her, that we would both be daily presences in her life. Mm. That dictated where we would live, which was a big deal, actually, because we had to move during that time and all sorts of things.
So you decided to move, to stay together with the move. One of you went for a job, the other one's going to find the job Chapel Hill.
Yeah, I mean, just to fill in that part of the story, we decided to split up in September of 2001. I was teaching at Bowdoin College in Maine at the time. I had one more year to go there. And in 2002, neither of us had an obvious job prospect, but we did agree that we would move back to Chapel Hill together, because there was not a question of one of us living in a city separate from where our daughter was.
So, Alice, forgive me, Jonathan. Alice, how typical is their story compared to the cases that you see?
Well, I'm amazed and would like to congratulate both of you, because it's very unusual that a couple can not only resolve their differences amicably, but together, after date of separation, decide to move for the benefit of their daughter. So I think this is the exception, but I think it's wonderful. And I think for your daughter, she will be the beneficiary of that.
How difficult is it, and what are the difficulties? Why is it so hard to get a divorce? People agree on one thing: we don't want to be together. That should be the start of what could be an easy break, Alice.
Well, the divorce itself is perfunctory. You just have to be separated 1 year and a day in North Carolina. But the children, the money, the property, that's where we see the struggle. Because most people, human nature is that you want as much time with your children as possible. And most people feel that most people are not excited about losing half of their net worth. And that's what happens a lot of times when they separate.
Can I just interject here very quickly and say one advantage we had was that we had so few assets.
Or frequent flyer miles.
Exactly, yeah, that part of the equation was never too big a problem for us.
That's the benefit of the simple life, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, so assets are one thing. Time with the children is another. What about the legal system itself? Does that, Alice, complicate things? I mean, once you see a lawyer or the prospect of going to court, does that make things more difficult, more easy?
Well, sure. It can become more difficult. And the goal, our firm, was to keep people out of court to try to resolve it. Mediation has become much more popular during the last several years. And you are successful if you're able to resolve your case in a separation agreement or mediation. Court is there, and the judges are great. We have a family court system. I'm in Wake County, but Orange County is the same type of system, that you'll have an assigned judge and they'll hear your case, but they're crowded. It's unpredictable in terms of when you'll get on the calendar. It's emotionally, financially draining, and probably one of the toughest experiences that people go through.
Why is the court different from mediation?
Well, mediation is often private, and you'll have a mediator go back and forth between parties who are either representing themselves or have an attorney, and they have control because they can settle, they can pick their own goals, they can do things that sometimes judges can't order, and different people have different priorities. So if you can settle and have a predictable result, that's the best option.
Why do some cases go to court then? If that would be your recommendation that they stay out, why would anybody – who does go to court and why?
People who can't agree. The issues generally that we see are money, sex, children, and including co-parenting decisions. Substance abuse issues or mental health issues will drive people to court. But if two people – I always tell clients it takes two to clap, and you may be the reasonable one, but the other side has to come to the table too.
You are married yourself, Alice. You have children. Your job is to work with people who are having difficulties. When you see so many divorces, has that had an impact on your ideas about marriage?
Well, I'm more committed to my marriage because I'm so thankful for my husband, with some of the people that I see on the other side of cases. But I think that divorce is probably one of the toughest things that people encounter in their lives. Even some people say it's worse than a death.
Mm-hmm. Well, on the state of things today, we are talking about divorce, talking with Alice Stubbs, and I want to thank you, Alice, for joining us. Alice practices family law at Therrington Smith LLP in Raleigh. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Frank.
My guests are Jonathan Weiler and Ann Mankins as well. They have blogged about their amicable divorce for Huffington.com. They will stay with us as our conversation continues on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow today talking about divorce as Law and Order Week continues. With us, Jonathan Weiler and Ann Mankins. They've written about their amicable divorce for HuffingtonPost.com. Both live in Chapel Hill. Joining us now from the public station WETA in Arlington, Virginia, is Kristen Salello. She is an assistant professor of history at City University of New York, Queens College, and author of the book Making Marriage Work: A History of Marriage and Divorce in 20th Century United States. Welcome, Kristen.
Thank you so much for having me.
Taking your calls and emails, 877-962-9862, SOT at WUNC.org. How would you describe your divorce? Do you know people who were involved in a divorce? Your parents? Do you have a story? Call us, 877-962-9862. So, Kristen, we're talking about divorce in the modern age. Obviously, this is not a new practice. Tell us a little bit about certainly it has been in the United States since its founding, right?
Yes, that's very much the case, and people are often surprised to learn that as far back as our Puritan ancestors, divorce has been available in the United States, which is something that makes it a little bit different from a lot of different parts of the world. And some of that has to do with the fact that Puritans felt that the family was a microcosm of the larger society, and that if there was severe disharmony within the household, it was bad for the rest of society as a whole. Now, in North Carolina, it would have been more difficult to get a divorce because they followed much more closely English common law, which was it was much more difficult to sever a union.
But what I hear you saying is that divorce became possible in Puritan England before the rest of Europe. Now, why was that? Why would that be true?
Or in Puritan New England.
In New England,
in the American colonies, yes. A lot of Western Europe obviously has Catholic traditions and Catholic roots, and so divorce was not a possibility there. And in England, you needed an act of parliament in order to sever a union. And so that was something that was obviously only open to the very wealthy and politically connected, whereas in certain parts of the American colonies and then after the Revolution, the new nation, it was believed that this was something that if couples had severe disagreements, that it was actually better for them and for the nation for them to be able to go their separate ways and perhaps form happier families through remarriage.
And as you suggest, it was different from place to place and more difficult than it is today. What were some of the reasons that you could get a divorce in those early days?
In those early days, it really had to be something very severe, I would say. A long absence or desertion, very drastic and physical violence within the union, and adultery. And adultery was one of these interesting cases where usually a wife, if her husband was unfaithful, she had to prove a couple other things that he had done for her to be able to get a divorce. Whereas for a husband, if his wife cheated on him, then that was something that was very problematic indeed, because obviously there were problems with under whose children was she having, etc. So it did vary, and it is always varied sort of by state as well, what list of things you were able to get a divorce on.
Now, in looking at your research, I found it very interesting that in the 1880s, we see the United States of America with the highest divorce rate in the world.
Yes, that's true. And that's something that has held through most of the 20th century. And the minute that Americans in the late 19th century were very interested in numbers and calculating things, and when they discovered they had this very high divorce rate, it led to this sense of crisis, and something that has continued through the 20th century. And a lot of that had to do with the fact that it was legal throughout most of the country. And frankly, if you didn't like the divorce laws in your state, you could always travel to another state and find a better venue in some respects.
What was going on there? Why were the divorce rates rising so quickly in the United States in that period?
I think it has a lot to do with sort of the American individualist tradition and the belief that, you know, and again, this dates back to the ideals of the revolution, that if you're dealing with a tyrant in the revolution, it was the king versus the colonies. In a marriage, it's, you know, a husband or wife versus the other spouse, that, you know, it wasn't acceptable to expect people to continue in that. And Americans were also really embracing the idea of marriage being based in love. And the idea was if there wasn't love there, that it was better for them to go their separate ways.
Divorce rates pretty steadily increased through the 1960s and 70s. Is that fair to say?
Pretty much so. There are a couple of dips. During the Great Depression, the divorce rate went down, but the desertion rate went up just because people couldn't afford divorce. That's something that we're seeing today in this current economic recession. And also during the 1950s, there was a slowing, but then when the rate spiked in the 60s and 70s, it had to do with the pent-up demand from the 1950s. But for the most part, the divorce rates rose really until the late 1970s, early 1980s. And then they've been on a slow but somewhat steady decline since that height.
Jonathan and Anne, I wonder what you know, we've seen the steady increase. You hear Kristen talk about attitudes about divorce being somewhat more lenient in the United States or open to the idea of divorce. But did it strike you as something sort of pathological, something we don't want to do, not just because of the pain for you, but the way you'd be perceived, the way your friends might be perceive you?
You know, one thought I have about that, Frank, and this actually relates to something that Kristen was saying a couple of minutes ago about causes of divorce. And this is something that Anne and I struggled with in a way that, you know, we didn't have an obvious sort of casus belli prompting us to get a divorce. You know, you had a clip at the beginning, happily divorced. And of course, Fran Drescher's ex-husband is gay, which is sort of an obvious reason for a union to dissolve. We weren't throwing pots and pans at each other. You know, we didn't have that kind of high conflict divorce. And I think it's obviously in lots of ways that's a good thing. But it did create a lot of confusion among friends and family because we showed fairly well. We didn't hate each other. It complicated matters in some ways as far as how our decision was perceived by, I would say, our community of friends.
Well, did you get the sense from some friends that you would somehow be a failure if you went through with this divorce, that there was something wrong with each of you if you actually got divorced, couldn't make this thing work?
I would say yes. I mean, nobody would say so quite so directly. But I do think there was that sense. And I think there is a larger sense, especially when, again, there's not some obvious overt act that you need to keep trying if you have children to stay together almost no matter what. And if you don't, that you've given up or you've acted selfishly or you've somehow failed in this most fundamental commitment, which is to your child.
Kristen, how have those attitudes, it seems to me they're very conflicted here in the United States, maybe elsewhere as well, but the idea that you would make it easier, that it is easier here in the United States, people are, as I say, open to the idea, and yet there's this feeling that, but you shouldn't do it. How are those ideas reflected throughout the period? Let's go back to 1880 and then up to the present time. How was it debated? Is it... Do people see divorce as simply a bad thing but an acceptable thing? What were public attitudes?
Public attitudes have always been, I think, conflicted is the exact correct word for it, that there's this push and pull about, well, people should be able to pursue their happiness and that, you know, they shouldn't be stuck in these unions that have these problems on the one hand, but then on the other, perhaps they haven't worked hard enough. Maybe they're being selfish and there's a reason they got married in the first place and they should pursue that. And I think one of the most interesting things that you've hit upon with Jonathan and Anne are the fact that once children get involved, that there's a real question about that. Is it better for unhappily married parents to stay together for the sake of their children? Or is it better for them to get divorced because their children shouldn't be raised in an unhappy home? And that's something that social scientists have been debating for at least the past 100 years with very little consensus. Mm. It's a really tough question.
Well, let's go to the phones. Elizabeth is on the line from Cary. Hello, Elizabeth.
Hi. I just have a comment. I was divorced 25 years ago from my husband of 20 years, and it was a carbon copy of Anne and Jonathan's divorce, up to the careers involved. The only difference was that we had an adopted daughter, and we had an internationally adopted daughter when that was not the most common thing in the world to do in North Carolina. In fact, you couldn't do it in North Carolina. We came down here from Massachusetts. But we did the mom's house, dad's house. We did complete joint custody, you know, all the access we could. And we realized, or I realized pretty early, that the things that had caused the divorce, the incompatibilities, the emotional incompatibilities, were also reflected in the way we were raising our daughter. So as she was 10 when we actually divorced, and we worked on it for years before that. And then when she got into her teenage years with all these problems of identity and everything else that she had, she also was able to manipulate the hell out of us. And we weren't as together as we thought we were. And we had an article written about us in the News and Observer because it was such an amicable divorce and the whole thing cost about $200. But I'm just going to issue a warning to Anne and Jonathan. Be careful about what it was that split you up and what kinds of, and how that affects the way you raise your daughter. And this, of course, is to other divorced parents as well. It was very bad for us.
Well, I thank
and
you for
my daughter, and my daughter is now in her 30s, and everything is resolved and wonderful, but it didn't happen until she had a child of her own and went through some very bad times.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Well, let's talk about that. First of all, how's your daughter now?
So she's almost 14. She'll be 14 in 3 weeks. You know, I guess I would say so far, so good. We would take seriously Elizabeth's warnings. You know, I think one thing I would say is that where Anne and I have always been on the same page is in terms of, I think, a very basic shared set of values and outlook about the world. And that has actually carried us through what were a lot of the personal difficulties we had in our relationship. And so at least so far, I think that has been reflected in what has been a fairly seamless way that we've co-parented our daughter.
It's interesting, too, Kristen, it probably gets into some of the difficulty that social scientists have had in trying to figure out which is better, stay together or break apart, because if you do have disagreements, there are families that stay together, mom and dad don't agree. One of the things children learn is how to work that out, because we've got to come up with an answer here. And when the problem, it doesn't sound like this is Jonathan and Anne's case, when the problem is over whether to let your daughter go out with the 19-year-old or not, mom and dad have to work that out. The child watches that. And, you know, if no furniture is broken, there's something that the kid might learn in that process. But again, each child is different and how they take that is different.
Right. And I would say that parenting teenagers together, apart, however, is a challenge, right? And
right.
They learn
right.
how to manipulate parents who are together or apart. So I think that some of that is a universal parenting
right.
problem.
Right.
That's what I was going to say, that you actually have to work together. I mean, ideally, work together even more if you're not in the same house parenting.
Well, and at least communicate, because you can watch a little better the manipulation that's going on when it's the living room and the kitchen and you hear two different stories from the same child.
Right.
Makes it difficult. Let's go back to the phones. Mary is on the line from, I should say, Beth is on the line from Meadows of Dan. Hello, Beth.
Yes, hello. I have a rather unique situation also. We got divorced when our son was 9. We were living in Vermont at the time, and Vermont has a very strong mediation system in place for people going through divorce. And the mediator really helped us to focus on our child, and that was the main concern. And my husband and I lived on a small lake just a couple houses apart for 2 years and had the 1 week on, 1 week off situation. And we realized we just couldn't stand being apart from our child, even for the 1 week. So we moved to Florida and moved back in together and raised as a divorced couple and raised our son up until he decided he wanted to go to boarding school when he was 16. So he went off to Massachusetts, and then we split apart and continued on our own paths at that point. But it was wonderful. It was just great. But our focus had to remain on our child.
Well, thanks for that observation, Beth. And I guess that was certainly behind your decision to move together to Chapel Hill, at least be in the same town.
Yes, and over the over the years, it's been, you know, we moved here. We lived maybe a block apart. Then when Jonathan moved, about 2 miles away, and then I moved. Now we live 7 miles apart, and that's the longest. And I think this story just shows there's so many different ways that people do it, and they work it out. And I'm really impressed with this, her story.
You talked about the reaction you got from friends and family while you were going through the divorce. Then you wrote about it on the Huffington Post. What kind of reactions did you get there?
Oh, my goodness. We get reactions along the spectrum. We have people writing in saying, thank you, this reflects my experience. I have this wonderful ex-husband, and he has a wonderful new wife. And we also get, and I quote, why are you trying to put icing on a dung cake? We get a lot. We often get the people writing who don't even seem to have read the article and seem to just want to say divorce is bad. Some have read and say divorce is bad. So we get a variety.
Kristen, I would imagine there has been that kind of judgmental streak that has characterized American popular sentiment throughout.
Oh, yes. I think that's very much the case. And I think that's one of the most difficult things about going through divorce and studying divorce, because there tend to be very strong, visceral reactions to it. And that spans across religious, you know, depending on your religious beliefs, upon your sort of beliefs in the value of counseling and those sorts of things. It's what makes this such a difficult topic. And because it's everyone's own personal experience is deeply private on the one hand, and then also has public ramifications on the other.
So why did you decide, Jonathan, and to write about this?
Good question. A couple of reasons. One, we've had friends say to us repeatedly over the years that you, the two of you, have done this so well, and this seems so unusual to us. And so there was a part of us that felt like, well, we had perhaps an interesting and not altogether typical story to share. And then I think another piece of it does have to do with this kind of ambivalence or judgmental nature of how people react to divorce. Because I think what we wanted to say was divorce does not have to be a catastrophic event for the kids. And in fact, really what matters more than categories of either being divorced or not being divorced are how couples go about their business once they do get divorced. And as we've been discussing, there's myriad ways of approaching divorce once it's already happened. And I think we really wanted to say that there are ways of being in divorce that can be quite compatible with good family relationships and a healthy environment for kids. And so I think both of those things are messages that we wanted to share.
You know, it seems to me that one of the things, a premise, perhaps an unspoken premise in the way you went about your divorce, is that we are in relationship and we will have to remain in relationship. So divorce, maybe there's a kind of fantasy that if I have a divorce, I will no longer have this relationship and perhaps never have had it. The whole thing becomes erased. That's never going to happen.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And, you know, I want to say one other thing about that, which is that over the years, when I've tried to think about what category to put Ann in, you know, we would come up with this. We would run into this sometimes. We'd meet somebody new. Maybe Ann would meet a friend of mine, and I would introduce Ann, and I would say, this is my ex-wife. And I have to say that label, while of course legally true, it did not feel like it represented well the nature of our relationship. I mean, from my perspective, Ann is family. You know, and we're doing something together that's the most, in some ways, intimate and close thing you can do, which is raise a child. And so it feels to me like there, in some ways, there's an inadequacy of terminology to reflect what the nature of these relationships can be.
on the State of Things today, talking with Jonathan Weiler and Ann Menkins. They're in the studio. They're an amicably divorced couple, live and work in Chapel Hill. You can read their essays about divorce at HuffingtonPost.com. Also with us, Kristen Salello, author of the book Making Marriage Work, A History of Marriage and Divorce in 20th Century United States. Coming up, we're going to take a look at the way divorce is reflected in popular culture and take more of your phone calls at 877-962-9862 on the State of Things. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking this hour about divorce. With us, Jonathan Weiler and Ann Menkins. They've written about their divorce at HuffingtonPost.com, live and work in Chapel Hill. On the line with us from WETA in Arlington, Virginia, Kristen Salello, author of the book Making Marriage Work. And joining us now from New York is Alyssa Rosenberg. She blogs on culture at the site thinkprogress.org. .org. And she is, of course,
.org.
Yeah. Well, and you are also a correspondent for The Atlantic.
Yes.
Got that right. Thanks. You can find you at atlantic.com. Alyssa, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here.
Taking phone calls as well, 877-962-9862 for your stories about divorce or observations and reflections. Emails at sot@wunc.org. Alyssa, Hollywood certainly has been shaping our understanding of love and marriage and divorce since Hollywood. One of the earliest looks at divorce, I suppose, The Lady Eve. What's going on in that film?
It's a very, very funny movie and sort of a perfect screwball comedy. Barbara Stanwyck plays a con woman who falls for a wealthy beer heir played by Henry Fonda, and when he rejects her on finding out what her actual background is, she comes up with a scheme to present herself again to him as a member of European royalty, cons him into marrying her, and then makes him so miserable that he demands a divorce. And she gets to that point only to find that she doesn't actually want to go through with it. And it's very poignant. I mean, she's on the phone talking to his lawyers. His family is trying to get rid of her as quickly as possible because of her sort of made-up, shameful sexual past. And she can't quite let go of him. So it's funny, but there's this real sort of winsome moment there. It's a comedy, but the emotions are very real. And the idea that even this sham marriage has failed is painful for her. It's very well acted. Stanwyck is irreplaceable, and it's too bad we don't have more actresses like her today.
Does the film say anything about the period in which it was produced?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's, you know, a very sort of stuffy Connecticut family. They're, you know, sort of wealthy and very concerned about, you know, appearances. And so that they would sort of pull the trigger and try to get this divorce to happen suggests that the main character, Henry Fonda's character, is in a situation where it would be more shameful to stay in the marriage than to go through the shame of the divorce. I mean, it's not exactly a normal situation. Most of us are not living multiple identities to get revenge on the man who embarrassed us on a cruise line. But it does suggest, you know, sort of a squeamishness about divorce and sort of where it fits into sort of other social norms and other things that could damage someone's reputation. So it's not at the top of the heap, but a sort of promiscuous European heiress is more embarrassing to have in the family than a divorced man.
Kristen, the 1950s, something in the golden age of the stable marriage, at least as reflected in pop culture, was divorce a big? What were the attitudes toward divorce during that era, the post World War II era?
There's two interesting things here. One is that right after World War II, the divorce rate went through the roof. 1946, super high. And it's something that was sort of the early marriages of a lot of the parents of the baby boom. They married someone sort of impetuously during the war and then got divorced. So that's something that's often forgotten. Also in the 1950s, I was really surprised to learn in my research that I found a Reader's Digest article that was called "Divorced is Going Out of Style." And I thought that's what the attitude was going to be. But in fact, there was a lot of concern in the 1950s about divorce. The rate that was often thrown about was that 1 in 4 marriages would end in divorce. Those statistics are problematic. But nevertheless, there was a real concern and a real effort to try to find new ways to, quote unquote, save marriages.
And what was behind that concern? What was the thought? Why was that a problem for all of us if some marriages ended in divorce?
Again, this is the Cold War era. This is a time in which family stability, not unlike the Puritans, was believed to be indicative of a healthy democratic society. And the concern was that if marriages were falling apart, families were being broken up, that it might be a sign of bad things to come for the country as a whole. And so there was really a concern that marital disharmony was going to breed much bigger social problems.
As we talk about the way this is reflected in pop culture and in media, Jonathan, did you become more aware of this, the way divorce was being reflected, and what are your thoughts about how we look at it?
Well, it's interesting that Kristen just mentioned a Reader's Digest article from the 1950s, Divorce is Going Out of Style, because especially since Anne and I have been writing about this, I think we've both been paying a lot more attention to pop culture. And there's been a spate of articles recently. For example, there was an article in the New York Times, a long article called How Divorce Lost Its Cachet. And so from my point of view, there's been a lot lately in pop culture to sort of question the choice of divorce and to suggest that there's been a backlash against the especially sort of open, if one might say, promiscuous nature of divorce in the 1970s, you know, exemplified by Kramer versus Kramer and that era. So I do think that we're sort of in an interesting time where we seem to be circling back a little bit to some earlier notions about divorce.
I have an interesting story, actually, because relating to how our daughter has viewed cultural images. And we were watching Ocean's 11 somewhat recently, just maybe a few months ago, and we were watching. And in that movie, I think that's the one where the main character is divorced. And he spends the movie trying to somewhat win back his wife, his former wife. And at the end, they do get back together. And when I was watching it with my daughter, and she said, "I wish they wouldn't do that, because that doesn't happen in real life. Divorced people don't get back together." Mm. And on the one hand, I was thinking we were trying to be consistent and never give her the false hope. But the other hand, I was thinking here's a staple of Hollywood romance that she does not charm her, you know, and it felt
very unreal to her.
Yes. A little sad to me.
And I would say that's something that dates back to the 1930s, what's called the comedy of remarriage, and that's sort of the assumption is that couples who were divorced really shouldn't have. And so
right,
the,
like the parent
marriages,
trap.
The parent trap or the Philadelphia story. There's all sorts of movies in which it's about, well, they got divorced for silly reasons, and really the true love is going to win out in the end.
Well, and Crazy Stupid Love, which I just saw 2 weeks ago, is the exact same genre of movie.
8-7. Go ahead.
I mean, I think Crazy Stupid Love is an interesting example of a sort of odd dichotomy in the way that pop culture often portrays divorce. I mean, if you're a woman, I think the idea is that the damage is done to you before you're divorced. Your mm-hmm. husband cheats on you or tries to trade you in for a newer model. But then after you're divorced, it's a time of renewal and rejuvenation, and you can sort of, you know, almost have a course correction. But I think for men, there's this idea that the damage happens after divorce, that, you know, if you look at something like the fantastic FX comedy Louie, the main character played by Louis C.K. in the sort of autobiographical show is really struggling after his divorce. I mean, there's a scene early in this season where his youngest daughter tells him really sort of thoughtlessly that she likes being at her mother's house more. So it's not just that he has trouble getting back on his feet with women. He's really vulnerable in every area of his life. And I think that's, you know, there are exceptions, something like Modern Family, where Jay, the patriarch, is divorced and very, very successfully remarried to the extremely sexy Gloria. But I think there's often this interesting sort of gender divide in how divorce is supposed to affect men and women.
Do you get that sense, Jonathan?
Yes, I agree. I think I've seen a lot of that myself. And in fact, even in Crazy Stupid Love, Steve Carell is sort of really dissolves after Julianne Moore tells him that she doesn't want to be with him anymore. And I do think that there is that sense that in some way in modern culture, men are at sea outside of intimate relationships and don't quite know what to do with themselves. So that very much resonates with my sense of that.
And while there may be a gender divide there, I think, Anne, you put your finger on something earlier, and this doesn't have as much to do with pop culture as just the emotional vulnerability that people feel once they go through a divorce, this sense of guilt that you can't let go of. I mean, if your daughter, you know, says, I wish they wouldn't do that, it's very unrealistic, that's a pain in the heart.
Yes, and, you know, she has said to us before, when she is sad about it, it's because it's if she compares herself with a family that's not. She's also said, actually, that when she's around friends whose parents are divorced, she likes that they have that in common. Hmm. So it's hard to tell where her pain is coming from, whether it's comparing herself with other people or if it is internal to what we've done.
Well, and it's interesting because parents who stay together can screw their kids up in a lot of ways and have a lot to be guilty about. But this is sort of one added layer that you always have to, I guess, question how much did that have to do with whatever it is. 877-962-9862. Give us a call. Ellis is on the line from Durham. Hello, Ellis.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. You still there? I think we just lost Ellis. Let's go over to Susan. She is in Chapel Hill. Hi, Susan.
Hello. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. I'd like to represent the future, and I'd like to state that we are focused on divorce and its effect on young children. However, we've got to remember that these children will grow, and they'll remember how their parents behave themselves through the divorce. The best day for me was when my son turned 25 and thanked me for how I handled things and he said, Mom, things could have really been different. And, you know, my sister and I really appreciate how you handled things. So while our focus does need to be on the young children, I think we really need to look ahead and remember that our children, as they age, will remember. And that's my comment.
Thanks, Susan. Yeah, which I think gets back to that point. You know, you raise kids and they're going to watch, they're going to have reactions, and those reactions change along the way. And ultimately, we all either do so well or do not so well. And again, watching how you managed it's kind of an interesting thing.
Yeah, and, you know, obviously we're in the – our daughter has now entered adolescence, and there is this uncertainty about the future, of course, that everybody faces with their kids. But I do think that – all of us have internalized to some degree this notion that if a child is a product of divorce, there's some bigger sort of warning signs or dangers ahead in what's already kind of an uncertain future. And I know that I've struggled with that, even though for the most part, I think we made the right decision for ourselves and even for our daughter. There is something about the decision we've made that it complicates our thinking about our kid.
Well, Alyssa Rosenberg, we talked earlier about this feeling, perhaps that Jonathan had that in the zeitgeist now, a sense that divorce is becoming obsolete, that it lost its cachet. I mean, is that something you sense now in the zeitgeist?
I mean, I don't really think that's true, at least in popular culture. I mean, if you look at the number of shows that are either started this summer or coming out this fall that star divorced characters, whether it's Hank Azaria's new show, Free Agents, Leslie Bibb's Good Christian Bells, the name has changed, so I always sort of stumble over that, Fran Drescher's Happily Divorced. I mean, I think that this is an issue that people are still grappling with through popular culture. I think Good Christian Bells will be interesting because unlike shows like The Starter Wife or Happily Divorced, it involves a woman coming home to her hometown divorced and sort of dealing with that as, you know, as a reputational issue and as a feeling that she's failed. Free Agents has Azaria trying to sort of deal with his divorce by sleeping with one of his coworkers, which doesn't necessarily work out that well. I mean, I think divorce is something, it's one of those issues that is very conducive to pop culture, either because you've got sort of a two-hour arc where the character can be healed and go on with their life, or you have the sort of ongoing exploration of what your life is like after the expectations that you had for it get upended. That's really good fodder for both sitcoms and dramas. You try something new every week, and you sort of stumble towards a solution that presumably comes at the end of a show, which is sort of synonymous with the end of the process, whatever that process is for a television show. So I don't think Divorce is any less visible. But I do think that, certainly on television, there are a lot of sort of creative approaches to looking at it.
Jonathan and Anne, you were very thoughtful going into your divorce. You were thoughtful coming out. And then now you've written about it. You've gotten a lot of feedback. What have you learned most recently, and how are your ideas changing as you move through this journey?
I guess speaking for myself, I would say that, the more I read about it, the more we write about it, the more we get comments from people, positive comments, negative comments, I think the more I appreciate just the impossible variability of the entire experience. I probably went into this process maybe feeling, a little bit more self-assured about having a particular perspective on what divorce is. And I think I'm probably a little bit more aware now of how differently people have experienced it.
Anne?
Well, one of the things that I've come to recently is the fear that a lot of people have about divorce who are not necessarily divorced themselves. And it's this abstract notion of it because they don't know. And it's the same. It's sort of like years ago, my sister said to me, she ran a preschool, and she said, I always hate it when the children say I'm going to dad's house or I'm going to mom's house. They never say I'm going to my house. And that made her feel bad for them. And for the children, it's a very concrete truth. They live in both of the houses. And as parents, we think of it. We have this abstraction about home, for example, and we think, oh, I'll never be home again. I can't create that for my child. But we can, actually. And I've sort of come to see this fear as well as some of the other feelings about it as being just abstract adult feelings that aren't really real for children.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program today. My guests, Jonathan Weiler and Anne Menkins, written for HuffingtonPost.com. Kristen Salello is an assistant professor of history at City University New York Queens College, author of Making Marriage Work, and Alyssa Rosenberg is a blogger for the site thinkprogress.org. Thank all of you for being on the program, and thank you for listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.